Half a second.
All right, while you're sitting down, can I welcome all of you? I'm going to try and bring this to a close by about 9 o'clock at the latest. So you have 1.5 hours. I know that we might be shortening your presentation time, etc. But I think you will realize that we've had a long day. So a very warm word of welcome to the chairperson and the chief executive officer of ICASA and the team. You've been waiting here on the wings for quite some time. This is a new committee. Maybe you can sense that the mood is also a little bit different. I don't know if you judge that to be a more pleasant, cordial environment or a little bit more difficult or more aggressive. But I think we will be kinder to you. So welcome to all of you, and can I hand over then to the chairperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Thank you, members of the Portfolio Committee on Communication. Well, it's really an honor for us to come before you on matters that relate to us accounting to you on an annual basis. We'd like to now make a presentation on what we intend doing for this coming year, the 2009 and 2010, with regards to our mandate. I think I'm quite aware that there are very new members of this committee, and I thought I should just summarize by saying that to give just a view and understanding sort of in a kind of a broad brush approach, indicate that we as ICASA, in terms of our role and responsibility, is to execute the policy objectives of government within the confines of the acts that govern us, which is the ECA and the ICASA Act. And to that extent, we have a relationship with the Department of Communication in the sense of implementation. And going forward, our mandate really, in a nutshell, is to act in the public interest. And in acting in the public interest, what we need to do is to ensure that we do have competition in order to make sure that goods and services or products are affordable, and also to license, as well as to look at the scarce resources, how to manage them effectively and efficiently, that is spectrum, numbers, and right of way. And also to look at the universal social obligation, because we know that operators will more normally go to areas where there is money, but in areas where there is really no business case, they may shy away from that, and in that respect, we have to impose some of the obligations. That's just in a nutshell for the bringing on to board the new members of this committee. Now, I have this as the agenda for the day. I know it's sleepy time now. Normally not the case even when I was at school to listen to a lecture for more than 6 hours, but for what it was worth, I think we had to bide our time, and here it is that we now have to have our presentation. Lastly, this will deal with the vision, mission, the value drivers, strategic objectives, and the organigram.
So, can I suggest that we skip all of those? We take it as a given. Let's get on to the core business from licensing and compliance.
All right. Licensing and compliance.
I know we don't have time. But I just want to ask whether you don't think it would have implications on some of the presentation that will be given us, if we are given part of the whole presentation. Because, you know, I realized when SABC was giving us this financial report here that we will end up asking questions that should have been given us by the strategy. For the strategy there, strategy plan they ought to have presented to us. Is it going to have implications again here? I just want to know.
No, I hear what you say, sorry. Yeah, I think we take the vision and mission as given. I mean, those are standard things that are there. It's on the document, on the record. I don't think we need to discuss the organogram of the organization at the moment. So I think they should get into the presentation itself.
Maybe the issue which is raised by Master is that the new members can ensure efficient and effective use of the frequency spectrum. They don't know what the frequency spectrum is. I think that's where the issue is. They can read the sentence in English, but what is the frequency spectrum? Maybe that's...
Right. Maybe you should just give us a few comments on the introduction then, yeah.
Okay. Maybe let me just say if we could look at our strategic objectives, that probably would be helpful. And I can fill in the gaps if it's so warranted. Clearly, if we look at the ICASA Act, it's nothing else but a convergence act. Since we moved in an area where now we have found ourselves because of technological innovation and advances with digitization, that actually all networks can converge and provide a common platform wherein all kinds of services can be provided. For instance, you can have fiber from which you can provide for television, you can use telephony, you can access the internet. You no longer have separate, like you had the computer before to access the internet, or you had television to look at content or football or news and entertainment. Now, this in itself, the ECA Act, is supposed to facilitate the convergence, as I pointed out, telecommunications, broadcasting, information technology, which really talks about computers. How you can use a computer to, you know, void. You can access internet, you can actually watch TV on a computer. We also have a converged system like a cell phone. You can access the internet with a cell phone. We are now will be moving to mobile TV as well as many other things like voice. Actually, the phone has always been used for just communicating, telecommunication. But it can, now that's really the meaning of convergence in a nutshell. So in that particular respect, I think the coming on board of the ECA was really in recognition of the fact that the paradigm has shifted because of technological innovation. Now, clearly from our role in terms of our mandate, we actually have got to make sure that we play a very important role in advancing the socio-economic development of the country. And how do we do it in that particular regard? We actually encourage competition, but you cannot have competition unless you license operators. And that is clearly what we are doing. The ECA allowed us to provide licenses for individual networks, means networks that can operate nationally and provincially, like Vodacom, MTN, and the rest. And of course, there are also SABC, etc., which is a national broadcaster. And many other aspects that relate to competition would mean that we have got now to get into licensing, which is a key issue. The key issue of licensing is really to advance competition, which we hope at the end of the day will actually create a vibrant economy and allow business activities and ensure that at least the consumer can make a choice in terms of price, quality, and service. Because if you have one-stop shop, that someone will say, take it or leave it. You go to a shop which only sells bread, and the bread is rotten, all that. Well, sorry, you can go wherever you choose to find. There's no other place. But even the choice, there's always a question of making sure that, to that extent, competition will serve the end user. Now, to ensure the efficient and effective use of radio frequency spectrum. Now, the spectrum is the air pipe. For instance, if you phone, your communication goes via the waves in the atmosphere. And that is called a radio frequency. In that radio frequency, there's your voice, there is television, there is data, etc. and on. And that spectrum is very, very scarce. And in that particular regard, we have to make sure that we allocate effectively and efficiently for good use to advance what we had intended to socio-economic development of the country. The consumers should benefit out of it. And as I may point out, telecommunication or ICT of now contributes about 6% of the GDP. It could be more because other economies are dying down, I mean like manufacturing, mining, etc. But it's still standing strong and steady, wherein I think to a very great extent it could leverage and save us from the demise that we are experiencing currently. Know that there is no other kind of business, be in the home, at work, in government, without ICT. So that's how core ICT is. It's almost a requirement to have an infrastructure that relates to not only ICT, but also roads, storm, electricity, and all those kinds of things. Because if you don't have that kind of infrastructure in any country, there is no way you can actually advance economically. If you don't have proper roads, you don't have electricity supply, you don't have ICT, you don't have airports, etc., there is no way you can start talking about developing the economy of the country. So ICT, infrastructure and all that is core to the development of the country. Needless to say, obviously, we should encourage investment, direct and foreign, and make sure that jobs are created. That's another very key important thing in that particular regard. And as a result, the economy will grow. That's just a given. Innovation in itself, as you well know, is the driver towards development, towards moving from one state to the other in terms of advancement. So one would clearly have to look at the situation where ICASA plays a very central role in making sure that we create stability and are predictable in our regulatory processes. We should not be second-guessed as to what is ICASA going to do. That's why regulatory stability, regulatory certainty has got to be established by the regulator, so that anybody who gets into this business is assured that there won't be a turnaround in a short space of time where they will start wondering, why did we get in for? And now because there is a shortfall of investment all over the world, money is running shy, we should do our level best in South Africa to ensure that we encourage investment from wherever it may be coming. Capital can go anywhere it chooses in the world. South Africa is not a God-given, predestined country where capital can go. We've got to attract it, like any other country does, and we have to do our level best. So the regulatory regime should ensure that in that respect, we do our level best to in competition with other countries to ensure that the growth of our country economically and socially at least could be predicated on the ICT. Predicated on the ICT is clearly more or less ensured. Clearly, one can talk about competition, but clearly it will facilitate in the reduction of doing business. Any kind of business, like I pointed out, be in the home, be at work, be in government, there is no way you can tell me that ICT is not playing an important role. This is how core and important this sector is. I already pointed out about universal access, that there are certain areas that cannot be reached because they don't provide enough profit for operators, so we must make sure that at least in that area, in those areas as well, those people derive benefits. Mention was made of the fact that there are certain areas that still do not have access to television, etc. We cannot just leave those people. They are part and parcel of South Africa, and they probably form the majority of the population. So 80% of the population of South Africa is in the poorer sector, 20% is in the upper class, and we have to take care in the essence of a democratized society, that those people not only vote, but actually derive the benefits of the largesses that are acquired through the new dispensation. Clearly, that talks to encouraging, of course, empowerment of historically disadvantaged persons as a result of legacy issues that we are working feverishly through licensing. Our regulation and licensing are not ends in themselves. There are means to ensuring that the objectives of the Act are achieved. So if we look at it from that point of view, we have a clear signposted direction as to where we are going and where we came from. And in that particular regard, we would like to be seen as a hub and a facilitator. That's where the vision came, to be a catalyst, to ensure that we have a knowledge-based economy and an information-oriented society. Of course, that's the organogram. So I think I've covered largely from our strategic objective, more or less a broad understanding of what we are all about. Obviously, vision, mission, objectives, and strategy should all be aligned, and the structure should fall in line to make sure that it addresses certain requirements in terms of resources to make sure that the vision and the mission is realized in the final analysis. As I say, we are signposted. We know where we are going and where we know where we come from. So, in that particular regard,
It was actually interesting to just have a look at the organogram, and I was just wondering if we could just ask which of the people are present here, so that we know the delegation.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. The organogram, as I said, is a consequence of our mission. Vision and strategy. So it is tailored to ensure that we live up to the mandate for which we have been prescribed to do what we need to do in terms of the Electronic Communications Act. Now, if you look at the Electronic Communications Act, there are chapters in there. There's a chapter 3 which deals with licensing. There's another chapter that deals with markets and competition, chapter 10. There's also an area chapter 4-5 that deals with the matters that relate to engineering and technology. Of course, consumer affairs also is considered in the ECA. So all of these things are really deriving. That's why I say we don't just do things, we are informed logically to move into certain areas because of the mandate that we have. This is the organogram that is supposed to deal with everything that relates to the ECA as a requirement in terms of our fulfillment. Now, we are structured in this manner clearly because we realize that at the end of the day, you see councillors on the sidelines there, they are involved in a regulatory matter, but they derive their sources, their resources, human resources, from the divisions. So the chairperson of any committee is the councillor. From there, the councillor will then say, in my committee, I would like to have individuals from these divisions because we don't want to work in silos. Everything that we deal with, be it markets and competition, licensing or technology, has got impact on the other. So we don't want to work in silos. So a project team has got to be formulated, and the staffing of the project team should be coming from this individual division. So general managers make sure that they train people accordingly, they deploy them accordingly in order to help with matters that relate to regulations for which councillors are responsible in terms of the act. And, of course, the lower line is the supporting activities like IT, CFO, compliance audit, HR, etc. I think that in itself gives a nutshell of how our strategy is. Okay. We're quite a team here, but if I have to go through anyone, maybe... Since I'm going to be doing a lot of talking, they probably have got to introduce themselves so that you can just hear how they sound in terms of their voice. Councillor.
My name is Councillor Nungu Isobaje. I'm largely involved with market and competition issues. Thank you.
Robert Mugula, Councillor.
My name is Funga Isibanda, also a Councillor.
Yes, Clovis van Rooyen. I especially deal with complaints, adjudication, and being part of the Complaints and Compliance Committee.
I am Thabo Mahage, also councillor.
Sobele Zokwe, Engineering and Technology.
Then wish maybe I should have said this before to offer apologies
for two councillors who are presently not with us here, largely because they also have prior commitments to be aware of. I believe one is on vacation, but out of the country, and this has been determined some time back. And the other councillor, Councillor Marcia Sutwiko, is out there doing some course on interconnection and things relating to frequency spectrum management. And then have, of course, general managers, the CEO. I think I'll hand over to the CEO in introducing the operational stuff.
The operational staff almost all here, and they include the general managers of licensing and compliance, market and competition, consumer affairs, legal, and the CCCC, the senior managers of IT, the GM for risk and compliance, our chief financial officer, the GM HR, the GM administration, and the senior manager communication. I will simply ask them to stand, cause, and you can see them. Okay.
Well, that being the case, I think, as I pointed out, the structure is informed by the strategy. And the strategy is informed by the mission, and the mission is informed by the vision. So there is a logical sequence in that respect. Now, then, of course, as I pointed out, what do we have to do with regard to licensing? What are the pressing things that we are faced with currently? In this particular respect, you may have heard that, as I pointed out, that the technologies are converging. Services can be provided by any other kind of platform. Now here we've got issues relating to having to license broadcasting services using a mobile phone. And we are getting into that environment, and it's largely informed also by technological advances. As a result of digitization, we now have digital video broadcasting and health. There's also satellite. And everything is going digital now. Analog is going to be confined to the scrap heap of history. It's found to accept its purpose, and now it's got to give way to innovation. And you can't beat innovation. If you can't beat it, you join, because then that way you can be sure that you will survive for the next day. Clearly, there was a requirement some time back because of the high cost of communication for government to step in as a strategic intervention. To that extent, of course, the government came up with a request that they should now provide broadband services at probably wholesale level, and then allow competition to take. This was what was known as the Infraco broadband, which is about to be licensed. It's a government network, fiber, that is going to play in the space largely as a wholesaler in order to make sure that at least competition is allowed at the retail level. And as we know, we are moving really into broadband now. Broadband means, of course, multimedia services, and multimedia services means quadruplay. Quadruplay means voice, video, data, text, graphics, and all that. All coming through one particular platform. It could be through fiber, it could be through your cell phone, it could be through a television, it could be through your laptop. So there's no more any distinction as to the kind of infrastructure that would provide any kind of particular service. That's really where broadband services will clearly leverage our country to advance in the area of information and knowledge management. In terms of the Act, we also have a requirement, Chapter 3 of the ECA, for licensing in terms of individual communication, electronic communication networks, of course, with regard to broadcasting as well as telecommunication.
Now, in that particular regard, I just wanted to point out, you all know about the court case that took place recently with regards to vans now being allowed to provide individual communication networks. That in itself has opened up the market. You said that I can say South Africa is the most liberalized country. Nowhere in a country can you ever have 500 electronic communication networks. What that will mean is that it's real free market. People can step in and step out. Nobody is restricted. If you want to burn your money and hoping that you will make business, go in. If you flop, go out. You can come back later. And I think that's really what the free market is all about. You know, you don't stop people and start micromanaging them and say, we don't think you will make good business. After all, there is always a David somewhere in the corner who will defeat a Goliath. So we more or less giving the benefit of the doubt to people that we may not have recognized because they are small, believing that they will not. So this was a good thing. Much as it went through some kind of difficulties with the legal court case and all that. But by and large, I think South Africa stands to benefit out of it because this is essentially what we want to see, competition. And the courts made it easier for us in this particular respect. Now, we also have introduced commercial radio competition over and above the competition that we have in what you call the primary markets, Gauteng, KZN, and Cape Town or the Cape Province. Those are seen as primary markets. There are radio stations there, but we thought we should also consider again introducing competition again there in order, again, for people to make choice in terms of content and quality of service, etc. And by and large, of course, we have an obligation with regard to broadcasting that we should make it as diverse as possible. It should reach all corners of the country in order to meet the individual needs of communities, regions, interests, etc. So we believe that this kind of initiative of really opening up in terms of competition and not holding back will serve us better well in the long term. The benefits may be not realized now, but at least we can say everybody is free to enter and go and come back and do whatever they choose to do. It has all been said about the fact that, as I said, analog is going to be put next to the bronze axe. It has had its day. We are now going digital. And, of course, that has been an ITU consideration. Largely because, not because people are sort of forced into digital, etc., but from an economic point of view, that's the one of the best way of ensuring efficient and effective utilization of scarce resources, the frequencies that we've been talking. They are just this much. And therefore, digital television through compression techniques, etc., will allow more to be provided out of the limited supply. So this is where innovation is and digitization is. So you have to deregulate as a result of that to ensure that at least you leverage the benefit that can arise from digital television. In that particular regard, of course, we have spoken, I think a mention was made of multiplexes. That's really where we now can say that there will be benefits arising out of digital telecommunication in the sense that when you multiplex, it's almost like, say, N1, and all cars move into N1. They're all coming from on-ramps. So the multiplex is one railroad where everybody jumps in, but people will jump out at their destinations. So that's really what a multiplex is. Get onto the train and get out of your station wherever you feel that you've got to go to. That's in simple terms what a multiplex is. And that in itself will save frequencies. One multiplex uses 8 megahertz of frequency. And that 8 megahertz of frequency before in analog, SABC1 had to do 8 multiplexes, eight megahertz, so 24 megahertz. So now we'll have 1.8 megahertz and you can get more than 8 channels in one multiplex. That's where the advantage is of digitization. So you can imagine how efficient your spectrum is going to be used. And of course, actually, I don't need to mention about high definition television, where you're going to get a crisp
picture with a clear sound of a CD. You sit back, it's home entertainment. That's really what the benefits are going to be. And clearly, that in itself is what we stand to benefit out of digitization. What clearly has happened is that there are going to be benefits arising out of this in a sense that there will be more spectrum released because you go digital, and that is called digital dividend. In other words, you're going to get a dividend out of digitizing. And that extra spectrum can be used for other services that have never been catered for. Maybe can also be used for telecommunication services, for public services, and any other thing. That will still have to be configured by the policymaker as to what they want to achieve with the digital dividend. So we are hopeful that we will be in for, shall I say, better times. The licensing clearly talks also about the review of regulations. Once you have a license, there should be standard terms and conditions. And the terms and conditions right now are under review because there is contestation from operators about certain items and agenda, one of which, of course, is about, if I were to say it right now, it's about people having to get their invoice in terms of the calls that they've made. We believe that they should provide, the operator should provide those billing statements for free. But the operators say they have there is a cost towards it. And we are battling on things like those. We don't think that if you go to a Woolworths shop and you buy grocery and then you get your slip, till slip, you are charged for that. Or if you have electricity bill, you are charged for that electricity bill to be telling how many kilowatt hours you have consumed, or a water bill. Now, we are having contestation with the operators. They say there is a charge. There should be a charge to the consumer for providing the billing statement, and that is a bone of contention. But we'll probably sort it out in the near future in terms of how they see it is a manner of how cost-effective will it be. Maybe they can send emails to tell you via email what your phone calls are, how much they cost, etc. and all. Especially in this era where you have dropped calls and delayed SMSs, you really need to find out whether you were charged for a drop call or how did some of the qualities of services affect you. And you don't have to pay to find out, you know, something that you've already paid for. So in that particular respect, I think we will be on guard to ensure that we protect consumer interest. Clearly, there are also class licenses as opposed to individual licenses, both broadcasting and electronic communication, as well as courier services. Courier services relate to postal. There is reserved area services like SAPO, and there's unreserved where a certain minimum kilo H or kilogram of parcel is supposed to be couriered. And below that, it's supposed to be SAPO providing that. There's also, of course, matters that relate to compliance. Of course, there's no doubt that once you license someone, you give that person rights and obligations. So you must make sure that those obligations that you impose are fulfilled. The question of public electric broadcasting, public election broadcasting that happened. You all know that clearly it was a huge cost to the, I must say, right now, without any equivocation. It was a very huge cost to the broadcaster because those minutes or hours that could have been used for advertising were provided for free because it was an obligation. And hence they suffered very serious reserves for that. And I would want to also appeal that consideration be given as to the mandate that the SABC is obligated to, and the funding model that needs to be reviewed in that particular respect, because they have no other option but to provide those services, the requirement from a national perspective. Clearly, with regards to universal service and access obligation, I already pointed out in this particular respect that we'll continue to make sure that the marginalized sectors of our community are also catered for.
in this particular regard, not necessarily only the 20% of the population, but 80% of the population are also taken into cognizance in this particular regard. Of course, by and large, the compliance regs will come up to make sure that there is a procedure and a process that is going to be followed as to how you comply, and if you are not in compliance, what the consequences are. It's a whole thing that can be spoken of, but I'm sure maybe if asked during question time, we can drill down to that. So we'll also be preparing ourselves for local government elections, which is 2 years from now on. And again, the mandate will be for the SABC to have to provide all of the, political parties to be heard for free. And there is a cost to that. While other broadcasters will be making their monies on the side because they don't have that obligation. So it's in recognition of that, I think cognition should be given in terms of the funding model of the SABC. Markets and competition. Clearly, as I pointed out in terms of the ECA, the key issue is how do we address issues of competition? We don't allow for competition for competition's sake. The idea is that the benefit of competition is that consumers will have choice in terms of price, quality, and service. So monopolies were the order of the day years back. They didn't benefit this country a cent. So we are still grappling with the legacies of monopolies. Whether it's a private monopoly or a government-owned monopoly, it makes no difference. A monopoly will always behave in a particular manner. So in that particular regard, of course, we have to look at review and develop regulations in respect of subscription broadcasting. Much mention was made of mass carrier obligations. Clearly, if you are on subscription, you still are entitled to watch what is known as public broadcasting. So that content must be carried. But the subscription broadcaster, is he obliged to pay for that mass carry? Because he never asked for it. It's the policymaker who ensures that everybody will have to watch necessary broadcasts that they should be seen by all and sundry. So that mass carry thing has got to be looked at philosophically or roughly be analyzed in its cost implications. SABC would say, we are providing them with content, they must pay. And those who say, no, we don't need it. It's government which says we must have. So there's always that. So I believe that the public broadcaster is facing a very serious challenge in many respects in terms of the obligation that he has to carry and also do certain things that really don't bring in cash. They don't need to be in a competitive environment. They provide a public duty, and in that respect, they should fulfill that obligation and get out of the business of competition. As we all know, we are going into the digital arena. We don't know what that would have as an implication for SABC. And the jury is out sometimes if you look at benchmark studies. Benchmark studies that they cannot survive. A public broadcaster will not survive it in the digital television environment. That has already been, and people have motivated that if mandate is still called upon, there must be a different funding model. Clearly, in this particular respect, I just want to mention with regards to the current era wherein we are. The policymakers, DOC, have come up with a period of dual illumination, wherein there will be analog and digital. Between now, 2008 it was, when the switch on came of digital, on a trial basis, let me put it that way, and that is going to happen concurrently with analog. So there is a huge cost. Once you carry analog and carry digital, you've got to have two transmitters. The same content, but on two transmitters. There is a cost to each one of them.
And that in itself, of course, tells us that we actually have got to provide more spectrum, because there wasn't any spectrum for digital. They're still on the analog platform, but you must give them more spectrum for digital. So for now, up until there is a total switch off of analog, there will not be any digital dividend, as it were. The only way there could be digital dividend earlier than expected is if we can have a hard switch over, which is suggested by MultiChoice, that they can provide a hard switch over and release some of the spectrum, for which then we can allow for competition. And that competition can come far much earlier. But if they stick to the dual illumination without a hard switch over, we'll probably wait until 2012 at the earliest to actually switch off our analog. In terms of the ITU, I think the date is 2015. Right, but we try to be, as normally is the case, the first in anything that we do, be innovative, etc. And normally we have budgeting problems, difficulties, and for the others will learn from our mistake and then do it better. We should review that date, because I don't think the date of 2011 November is really practical. We have to talk to the minister about shifting that date to a further date. But those who can switch over into a hard switch over, as I put, into digital, so that they can release the spectrum, hey, that will be welcome. Because then the people who are crying and shouting on us, you are only allowing multi-choice, so that we can say, you know what, we now have spectrum. The reason why we don't allow any further competition with digital terrestrial is that we don't have spectrum. But until someone releases the analog spectrum they have, we can then say, okay, let's allow for competition. And I think suggestion has been considered by ICASA, if it could help remove the burden on us, because sometimes we are accused of favoring one operator over the others, while not taking into cognizance that the very scarce resource that we are talking about is not available. So in that particular respect, I think we will do our level best to ensure that going forward, we will ensure that we make this environment as competitive as possible. Now, the review and development of broadcasting regulation also looks at things like advertising, information, and sponsorship. As we pointed out, the SABC is obligated to provide certain services which are not commercially attractive, because it's a requirement. And to that extent, we also limit them with regard to advertising time, because we want to make sure that they use that time for what really is their mandate. And in that particular regard, as you must have heard, 85% of their revenue is derived from advertising. And if we now restrain them and say, have less advertising and more content in terms of the obligation, then someone must make sure that the money that they are losing through advertising could be provided for by other means. It should be a balance of the two. More content, less advertising, who compensates for it? Like we talked about when they did the election broadcasting. They were providing that for free, and that time could have been provided as advertising. But they never did, because they were not allowed to. Let's take much of the things that I'm talking about here as a given. You know, local content review, etc., has already been alluded to, which we'll have a look at. Ownership and control of commercial broadcasting is also something, because we want to make sure that historically disadvantaged individuals or groups of prior years are brought into the mainstream of the economy, not this whole thing of second economy. Because second economy is nothing but hawkerism. Someone selling bananas out there in the street and hoping that one day you'll be in Main Street. There is a slight chance of that person being in the Main Street from selling bananas in the street corner. Besides, they've got no refrigeration. The bananas get rotten within that day. If they don't sell them on that day, that's it. Must throw them away. Or maybe make some banana cakes out of it. Clearly, with regard to competition, there are a lot of things that need to be pointed out. One of the scarcest resources, and nobody would believe this, is numbers. You know, your telephone number, etc. Because they are within a certain band of 11 digits.
So you can count up to how many million numbers you can have. They must therefore be used efficiently and effectively. And therefore, to that extent, there must be some way of having a database to do a number audit as to whether these people are utilizing the numbers that they've been given effectively and efficiently. So there should be a certain percentage of usage of the numbers. If not, those numbers must be released and returned back to ICASA. But also in terms of the ECA, that we must now consider charging for issuing numbers to operators. I think it should also be understood, operators always pass the cost to the consumer. So it's a double-edged thought. While you are trying to benefit the consumer, you say, no, we are just passing over to you. This is what we are told we are supposed to do. There is a cost for doing business. So sometimes when lawmakers craft this thing, they don't look at the consequences of what they want to achieve. The things end up being at cross purposes. If the intention was for the consumer to benefit, then, of course, we know that the operator will not pay for that without costing it and therefore providing a price as a result of costing because they are in business. Number portability was introduced really to also encourage competition. We had introduced it way back 2006 and after much struggle, but at the end of the day, it saw light and but if one were to look at the impact of number portability with regard to competition, the benefits have not arisen. Largely because I think there is a huge cost to porting once you move from one operator to the other. Especially when you want to port in the middle of your contract. You are obligated in terms of your contract to pay the contract off. And that in itself stops you from wanting to port when you consider the cost of porting. But by the time you consider porting when your contract ends, you may have forgotten that, gee, I thought I was going to port 6 months from now on, and the next thing, you are hazy about it, and say, let me just continue. So we hope that somewhere along the way we'll do an impact analysis and find out precisely what we can do to give effect to competition through number portability. It's not a lost cause. I think it's a matter of educating the consumer as to when to port, when the contract ends, and make sure that they are not seduced into continuing with the operator if they are not satisfied with that operator. That in itself can create competition because if one company does not want me to port, they better serve me well. That's all. Because I can go to another operator. We clearly have a lot of issues with regard to markets and competition in terms of the framework that we have got to develop towards the operators in terms of how they report their financial system. But let me point out that the chapter 10 of the ECA, which really talks clearly on competition, is to first allow competition to thrive, but if it is such that there is a significant market player who abuses his dominance, there's nothing wrong being a significant market player because you probably provide the best service, high quality service, at the lowest price. Therefore, people would want you to serve them, and therefore you become a significant market player. But if you abuse your dominance in that particular respect, then the regulators got to step in and impose pro-competitive measures. Some of the things are cross-subsidization, predatory pricing, and margin squeeze, which we have to look at. And if that is found, I want to point out, being a significant market player is not a sin. What is sinful is when you abuse your dominance. And that is what we will zero in and make sure that when we identify that, we'll certainly impose pro-competitive measures. So there are also issues relating to price cap regulation, where there is a basket of services that the telecom is providing, like line rental, local call, long distance call, international call. They're all in a basket there. But it's such that all of those, averagely, the price should not be greater than CPI minus X, where X is a sort of a number that is agreed by the operator and the regulator. And that in a way gives us a sense of making sure that costs are really contained, to that will affect the consumer. And in that particular regard, we've read some tricks being played. For instance, international costs by themselves are competitive. And therefore, the operators like Telkom are bound to reduce the cost if they want to get market share. But then it is put into the basket. And therefore, the price is reduced. And the other price, because average the price must be at a certain level. We are thinking of removing competitive services out of the basket and making sure that the uncompetitive services are the ones that are in the basket, because the competitive ones will naturally go down. So that balance has got to be created. Otherwise, we then are just working at cross papers. We'll never achieve our objectives in that particular. Any competitive service must be taken out of the basket of services. On all those that are non-competitive, then they must be price regulated in terms of price cap regulation. Of course, CoaChem, of course, is also another aspect where we determine the cost of every service that is provided and determine what price is charged. That's really what CoaChem is all about. List out all the services that you have provided, what was the cost of those services, and how much are you charging, so that we can just find out, you know, how much profit you're making. That's what CoaChem is all about. So we do analysis of this, and at the end of the day, we can zero in and say, you know, you are charging too high, this is above inflation, and many other things. There is a basis for arguing if you have that. Because without that, then you say, no, just bring the price, and he ends up saying, no, you say I must reduce my price, but my cost is this. If I have to reduce this, then I don't have to be in business. So we want that revelation from them as to what the cost is of providing the services, and find out what the price is for that. That is being worked out by ICASA and collaboration with the operators in this particular, both mobile and fixed line. There's a whole plethora of issues that could be discussed here, but I've already alluded to competition chapter. There is also the handset subsidy regulations that we have. We haven't finalized them, but they're really designed to help the consumer and some of the difficulties that the consumer is experiencing. For instance, whether this handset that they're given, is it subsidized, or do you pay it at a later stage through higher patches? You know, after you are in a contract, your contract is 2 years, you're told you'll be paying $300 a month, etc., and all that. And if you consider $300 a month times 24 months, then you find out, well, I'm actually paying for that cell phone. It's just a higher purchase. But this has been clarified through the handset subsidy, which we are working out, the regulations, and to make sure that there is actually transparency in saying the cost of making calls is this and the cost of your cell phone is this. So that if it's free, then it must be very clear that this is free. We're giving it for free only if you make calls, etc., so that people are not confused by marketing gimmicks or talking about subsidies, etc. You probably are paying with interest if you consider having to pay that over 24 months, and you add up, say, I could have bought it for 6,000, now paying 7,500. So I paid an interest on this, like I'd buy a piece of furniture. So those are the things that we want to have them made transparent. In that transparency also, we are very much worried by what is normally a legal practice of making small print of terms and conditions. That's a real concern. You can't even read them. Somewhere you sign, but you haven't even understood what the terms and conditions are. Looks like it's a legal practice where terms and conditions are written in small print. We really want that, unless I have something to look through and embolden the letters, I will not even know what I'm signing for. But in the event that they still keep the small print, they must explain verbally to the person who acquires these services of what the terms and conditions are. So those are the things that we are really looking at in terms of handsets. Local loop and bundling is an issue, obviously. As you know, there is only one dominant operator with regards to access to the home via telephony. Needless to say, he's just there in front of me, looking straight into the eye. That's Andrew Barron's service. And I was kicking and screaming and saying, no, I should not bring you forth on this thing because there are other means of addressing local loop through wireless and other means, the fiber draws out, etc. We will see. We'll invoke markets and competition chapter 10 and see how far we go with that. Since no other replication can be made of putting other lines of telephony into homes, it's financially infeasible and technologically infeasible. So that's where they then end up becoming natural monopolies. And in that particular regard, of course, we must unbundle that local loop for other people to access those consumers that they've locked into their line. So in that particular respect, of course, as I pointed out, there are also facilities, for instance, I think it's a set three, yeah, for which Telkom has been the dominant operator, and that also is an essential facility. What do we do when we have an essential facility? Fortunately now, I can say to a certain extent, we are having now fiber coming up in droves, if I were to use that term. Seacom, I'm told Easy Cable, there is Hulunet, Mojanet, there's Intraco. So there is a likelihood that something can happen, and this gives effect to the fact that competition is really the panacea. Our role is to come out of regulation and to look at compliance of services. Regulation really can be handled by the market because customers will make a choice without us stepping in and dictating to operators as to how they should behave. Once you have competition, consumers will make a choice. And that in itself, I think, is what needs to happen in South Africa. Regulatory impact assessment is normally, as we say, we don't regulate for the sake of regulation. We want to find out what is the impact of our regulation. Does it achieve the objective? If it does not, then we have to look at it and review it and see whether the costs that were imposed by to operators to come up with that particular regulation has really benefited the consumer. And there needs to be a review. Like all times, when you have a theory, you must put the theory to experimentation. Only after experimentation will you say the theory works. It's unlike, I'm told, economists. When something works in practice, they ask whether it will work in principle. But we are not there. Let's move to engineering and technology.
Chairperson, whatever the presenter has had, I think the committee needs a little bit of that energy.
You see, my fears are coming through. I tried to feed him on earlier. He said, no, that didn't take us to the presentation. I know the chairperson. You are new members. And the tactic here is very simple. You speak, if the meeting is due to end at 9 o'clock, you speak till 5 to 9. And you ask questions in 5 minutes. But we are going to go home past 11 o'clock, I promise you. So if the chairperson can speed up this.
You have seen it all, unless you want to ask questions, and I can just stop right now. With regard to engineering technology, which is also another aspect of our regulatory responsibility, in this particular regard, as I pointed out, really the issue there is how we manage scarce resources, the frequency that we have, and how we have it allotted, allocated, and assigned. Allotted or allocated would mean that certain bands of frequencies will be for broadcasting, others will be for telecommunications. Assignment is if we give an individual operator that you, SABC, will have this particular bandwidth to operate, or you, Vodacom, you will have this band to operate. That is what is called assignment. And of course, there are a lot of areas that we have to deal with, like some of the scarce resources, and people may ask in later sessions about what are we doing with the spectrum that is in high demand. Currently, we are dealing with the one on 2.5, 2.6 and 3.5, and we'll soon be coming up with the regulations
and criteria as to how that spectrum is to be allocated. There's only about 126 megahertz of spectrum there, but I can assure you there are probably 400 or 500 operators who want 126 megahertz of spectrum. So then we have to use some criteria. First, our criteria will have to address socio-economic or objects of the act, whether we achieve some of the things like the rural coverage, tariffs that would be affordable, or whether we go the auction route, which will be the far much more easier. The one who values the spectrum and is prepared to pay the highest price should go and have it. But does it result in socio-economic advances for the majority of the population? May not be, because that person will have paid a high price and would like to have return on investment. So those are the kind of issues that we have to deal with. So we'll look at the duty parade, as it were, and or auction. Let me put it that way. And or auction, but primarily duty parade. Quality of service, this is really what I really would want to move into. Some of these things are too pedestrian and mundane. But you know, recently there have been problems about quality of service with regards to networks. Maybe I'm preempting a question here, but I just want to assure you that we are on top of the problem. The delayed SMSs and drop calls, etc., have been addressed via the operators. They came to meet with us, and we understood their problem, but somewhere we didn't accept their reason for not providing quality of service, because it's a requirement. If someone pays for a service, then, of course, obviously, you must get value for money. And in that regard, they've been put on terms, that failing which they'll be brought before the CCC, if they don't live up to. And we pointed out that they should start becoming innovative right now. We'll be facing 2010, and suggestions were made that they should look at contingencies and redundancies, and look at mobile base stations, because when the area is dense, the radio resources are less, calls will drop, and SMSs will be delayed. Therefore, they need to bring in some other kind of technology, which a mobile base station would help if that particular base station is overwhelmed, or they can put in what is known as the base stations that we have are called macro cells, but there is also what we call micro cells and nano cells and pico cells, which can address some of the areas like hotels, convention center, where there is a big concentration of people. You can always work out what kind of a cell you need. In a convention center, you can put in a micro cell there, or a pico cell, or a nano cell. So quality of service really is the thing that I really would like to talk on. The national frequency plan will definitely be brought forth in order to understand the migration process as to what's going to happen, which frequencies are going to be available for what services. And we also anticipate that out of this, as I talked about the digital dividend, that we will be able to provide other services that probably have not been as yet considered, like mobile services that seem to be the key issues that we have to deal with. People may wonder, but there are more people who have cell phones than they have laptops or computers. So we need to leverage the cell phones, whether we can really live up to what is known as an information-oriented society. The cell phone can access the internet. You can therefore create a knowledge-based economy. You can do banking via the cell phone. The government can send information to you without having to go and send long queues if you're going to come and collect your birth certificate. Right now, I think even students who are studying get their results via mobile services. So you can realize that we need to leverage the mobile telephone, because I think in South Africa, probably the penetration with regard to cell phones is in the 70%. So
it's one of the, actually it's a success story for South Africa, for Chukwudan, with regard to the CST, Community Service Telephones. We are able to cover large rural areas through these community service telephones, and the income connection price, which is the issue relating to pricing. With regard to community service telephones, the internet price has been fixed. I mean, the interconnection price to 6 cents. The cost of interconnection is 6 cents. But these areas that have to be covered are rural areas, maybe townships, etc., and all that. So to a certain extent, universal access and service, I think South Africa should stand proud and say it's one of the best that has provided universal service and access. Not that we have to be complacent and lax, because now we have to look at broadband services, which is the next thing of universal service obligation. This is the last consideration with regard to consumer protection. I've alluded to some of the things in my discussion with regard to how we are there to protect the consumer by encouraging competition and also resolve issues of complaint. There is a consumer advisory panel, which is a statutory body. Its role is to advise council as to what the needs of the communities, what the communities are crying out all about, so that we can begin to address the concerns in the far-reaching areas of the country. We also will conduct workshops, radio interviews, and all that to make consumers aware of what their rights are. And that in itself, I think, will be very, very helpful. Surely, I'm sure questions will be asked about finalization of primarily the E-rate. I can see we have developed the regulation. There is no doubt about that. And then we had a question from the DOC saying, but, you know, the E-rate, which talks to when internet services are provided to schools, they should pay 50% of the commercial price. This is in terms of the regulation. But now, it's very, very clear that some of the schools cannot even afford 50%. So we are thinking that they should be zero rated, but someone must pay, because the operators will say, we'll only pay 50%. The question is, who should pay the other 50%? In order for schools, libraries, and all these areas that really need to be enhanced in terms of the knowledge economy to reach the internet. We believe that the Universal Service Fund should be the one to provide the 50%, because monies are being collected from operators to make sure that they provide the Universal Service Fund in order that those funds are utilized for the unreachable areas through maybe where operators will not be keen and interested, then the government can say, we've collected this money from these people. I think it's 1%. Is it how much? What percentage? 0.2% of their gross, which is piled up, and I think it's sitting with National Treasury. It has been piled up for a number of years. It has not really been used for its purpose. So that can help address the E-rate issues. And other issues of universal access and service, where this money could be used in a sense where there could be tenders, say, anyone who wants to provide services in that remote area, here is money, tender, and then provide those services. That in itself, I think, is what I could say in this short period of time. I will hand over to the CEO to deal with operational issues.
It'll be even shorter. These are just some of the lists of the issues that we're dealing with operationally, Councillor. 2 years ago, we came to Parliament. The Parliament queried the locus of ICASA. So we've done a study in conjunction with Treasury, and we're in consultation with the Department of Public Works to look at a new site for ICASA that is accessible both to the public and to the employees of ICASA. We're having a look at the location of all regional offices in terms of the same framework, whether we need additional regions, and work on that is continuing. We will have a new office in Cape Town fairly shortly, and we believe it will be far more accessible than the previous office. We're going on a continuing process of realigning ICASA to the mission statement that is contained in the ECA. To that effect, we're conducting a number of audits. The first on the qualification audit of ICASA staff, then we're doing a skills audit, because qualification and skill are not always identical. And we're doing a far larger assessment of, is ICASA positioned to undertake the task that the ECA mandated to do so. More or less in line with what the SADC spoke to, we need to make sure we are fit for purpose, as it were. The ECA mandates that ICASA may only charge operators in terms of licensees what it costs ICASA to provide in terms of regulation. So we have to undergo a thorough costing study that looks at the cost of each of ICASA services and the overall operational cost of ICASA to ensure that when we levy a license fee, there's a relationship between what we're doing and the licensee imposed. On the IT side, we're working through a process of tendering, whereby an enterprise resource platform will be purchased so that we can have a far better utilization of services, better capacity to do some data mining of information, and hopefully to have a more effective organization. As part of the process of relocation, we're also trying to ensure that we locate no regions in head office. We have two regions located at head office presently, and we'd want to relocate them to areas of need as opposed to being located at our head office. We're also going through an extensive stakeholder communications process to make known ICASA's program for the year. For a large part, people don't understand what ICASA does, when it's meant to do, what it's undertaken to do. So we're in the process of communication not only to Parliament, which we'll do shortly, what our entire program consists of, but to our own stakeholders and to the country at large, what we intend to do year to year. In line with that, we are undertaking a PMS, introducing performance management for all staff and all of council, as is mandated by the ICASA Act, and to ensure that that is aligned with the business plan. Okay. I think that's about all that needs to be spoken to at this time, to the business plan, and to the operational issues. Budget. ICASA is a fairly straightforward organization in terms of structure, and it does not have the operational complexity of an organization like the SADC. How we operate, we operate out of grants granted from the DOC. In this year, with financial year, we've been afforded $269 million to operate out of. We do, however, we are, however, in a dispute with the DOC as to the allocation of the postal regulation. It's been 2 years now that we've been in dispute about this amount of money. As the function of postal regulation was transferred across the ICASA, but the funding for it has not been. We had to fund postal regulation out of savings, and we're hoping to resolve this with the DOC to ensure that we obtain this grant money that was meant for postal regulation. As is stated here, the cost of administration and general expenses is $37 million. Staff costs $149 million. Audit fees to date have been just under $2 million. And other operating costs are $58 million. On the project side, the project expenses for the year are listed at $35.5 million, of which licensing and compliance will take $6.8 million, markets and competition $7.7 million, engineering $5.3 million, consumer affairs $4.5 million, and various support functions 11.2. In total, the allocation, if we include the outstanding postal grant, amounts to 279 million. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and the CEO. Here we have a very comprehensive meeting. Open questions and comments. Mr. Kulwani.
Chair, maybe the Chairperson normally says Ofika, not you, Chair. He normally say there is the sea is infested of sharks, which they are navigating at. Today he's talking about the David in a corner waiting for Goliath. So the things are coming up bit by bit. But the first issue, Chair, I just want to ask, who's Goliath and David in this case between ICASA and the industry players? Because last time you had a problem where ICASA just surrendered cases or five cases and ended up 70. Because they don't have the financial leverage of fighting the industry. And as a result, in most cases, been compromised in terms of their work, which they're supposed to do. Maybe the chair will clarify with Goliath and David under that circumstance when those things happen and so on. But the other issue, Chair, which I wanted to check was in relation to our Chair, maybe before I go to the issues, is that, Chair, if I'm correct, Councillor Zogwe will be finishing his term end of June, if I'm not mistaken. And from our side, maybe the ANC or as the study group is permitted, we would like to thank him for his availability to serve in ICASA. I'm sure with vigor and dedication in terms of the work allocated to him up to now, Chair. I might not comment in terms of what will happen because there is a possibility of reappointment and other things. But I'm just talking from the time, Chair, where he has been serving as a country, that indeed we value his contribution in ICASA. I'm not sure whether it was him or the collectiveness of ICASA, because at the time when he came in is when ICASA was starting to be stable. It might be coincidental, I don't know. But it was the time when ICASA was starting to be stable after they traveled the troubled sea water, which the SAPC is currently swimming in and so on. But I just wanted to pass that, Chair, so that if we don't see him, I don't know when are we going to meet, whether we're still going to meet with ICASA before the expire retirement. So we might meet on the interviews, I don't know, for the new, for the possible appointment of the vacant position. But, Chair, there's one issue, Chair, which was raised by the post office when they made their presentation. The chairperson has dealt with the matter in terms of the 1 kg issue, with the letter issue, where the postal office, if you go the exclusive, the monopoly, I think the good one this time around, not the first one the chair has been alluding to. But the question, Chair, is that the postal office has raised a matter that the monitoring of compliance, the role of that, it seems to be a daunting task from ICASA, the monitoring. An example was meant by municipalities who deliver their own letters and no one is saying anything. It's normal. But you've got an agent which is paying in terms of their license and so on to have that in the headquarters exclusive rights and so on. I just wanted to get what the comment of ICASA around that particular matter. They are able to monitor the compliance around that particular matter and so on.
The other issue, Chair, which has been raised, the issue with the chair clause, with the issue of the E-rate was on top of my questions. But the chairperson has dealt with that particular matter. But Chair, I was just going to like to understand what does it mean with the regulation? Because there seems to be some cheating problem to go full steam. I'm not sure whether the teaching problems there are in relation to the no-fee schools, as the chairperson is indicating that some of the schools they can't even pay, which I think is a policy matter that you can declare school a no-fee school fee, no-school-fee school. On the other hand, you expect that school to pay for some of the services like the internet and so on. I think the view which you are talking about of a possibility as a policy matter to tap on the USAFA funds might be a solution around this particular matter. But I just wanted to check whether now, because the regulations are there, it's a smooth sailing, and it's not the sea which is interested to chuck, as the chairman says. The other issue, Chair, I want to get a clarity. This morning we were told, I just want to check whose role it is to make sure that SAPC cover all the political parties during the election equitable. Is the pressure from the political parties as Bantu General Holomisa claimed, or is the responsibility of ICASA to make sure that SAPC do comply with their license conditions? I just want to get clarity for that for record so that they were clear. So who's got the responsibility around that particular matter? The issue touched by the chairperson around the issue of internet interconnection. Now, Chair, the chairperson has indicated that it's one of the cost-driving issues in terms of the industry, in terms of this connection, interconnection. Now, Chair, I know there were attempts by ICASA to deal with this matter. Where are we? It's a matter of Goliath and David. That Goliath can step out now because David is just around the corner, ready to hit to Goliath. But I'm raising this matter because it's a fundamental issue in terms of the cost driver of the communication and so on. But I don't know where are we in particular to that matter. The last one, which you can't raise it at this time of the night, but maybe we need to check the Vodacom deal and the involvement of ICASA thereof. What really happened? I don't need a response, Chair, with saying Zombela and Master, they are not here. Because they were not alone in those meetings. There were other councillors who are here who participated in those issues. So I won't take that response, Chair. We need a full accountability from ICASA on what really happened. And they must be able to provide an answer. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair, I'm largely covered. I just wanted to add two more little issues to the issue of Vodacom. Firstly, may I just ask the decision from the DOC, we understood, because we asked the question, we put the question to them as well. It was rather strange that two entities, the DOC and ICASA, split on the decision, and DOC said to us that they were surprised and they informed ICASA that they were not happy with it. So, can we just hear, why did the board reverses the decision at the very last minute? Secondly, was it a unanimous decision of the board? How many people voted against it? And thirdly, what are the cost implications? Because it is clear that the ruling was that ICASA should also pay for the cost of Vodacom. We just want to know what is the extent of that. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. I would like to know what is the working relationship with Centec and how is that working relationship? You know, I am asking that is that sometimes you find that this community radio station, sometimes they disappear 1 or 2 hours on air, and at a later stage they come back, and sometimes it's something that happens frequently and things like that. And so that's why I need also to understand your working relationship with Centec and things like that. Another thing is that there is a view from ICASA to surrender their mandatory regulatory mandate to operators or industry. Then my concern and my question, what will happen to the poorest of the poor, and who will defend them and who will protect them? Because if you are regulating the industry, in other way you are protecting those who can't protect themselves. Because if we're saying the industry must regulate, and you know what will happen. This free market system has failed even in USA. So the other question is that in your view, does the environment conducive for unregulated competition as you have suggested? Taking into cognizance that these people coming from the different, at the same time you are there also to assist those whom I will refer to them as historical disadvantaged people, who want also to play a certain role. And if we're saying, let us open up a free wholesale competition without playing a certain role in regulating that. Do you think that the environment, in your own view, is conducive for that, or is favorable for that, or, yeah.
Really?
Thank you, Chair. I'm being partly covered with the issue of the Iraq, but I wanted to check that the when does the CASA, because I didn't hear you mention it clearly, do you intend to implement the handset subsidy regulation? Because if you go check, it mostly affects most those vulnerable people that are not aware in terms of this regulation. The other is that what are the cost implications in terms of the switchover program? We're talking in terms of this, you know, the switchover program that is going to take time and delay up to 2012 or 2015. We want to check what are the cost implications, if we can be able to find ones of that can be able to assist us to switch over, so that we can be able to use this digital pen. But I want to check what is the relationship in terms of between the ICASA and the ISCOM, because I understand that ISCOM is also using the network services. But what are the processes in terms of those aspects? Because as that network as well, that's also used. Lastly, I just noticed that in terms of your budget, you mostly budgeted more in terms of your staff costs. I want to check whether your project expenses, your engineering resources, how do you also manage so that you also ensure that there's no compromisation in terms of the quality services that is also given out. Thank you. Can I also throw in my question so that you have them all in front of you? I'm interested in understanding
what you understand by independent in the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa. What does this independence mean? I don't believe there's something called absolute independence. I'm asking this question because in the Vodacom issue, I am led to believe, and I haven't seen the written confirmation of this, but I'm led to believe the former President of the Republic signed off this deal, committing this government, all its entities, to that deal. President of the Republic, Halima Mutante, signed off the deal on behalf of the government, committing this government and its entities to the Vodacom Telkom deal. The government was a part shareholder in Telkom and had to make that commitment, at least to the other side that's dying out. Now, IGASA chose to contest that in court. Not that specifically, on another issue, on a related issue of the public hearings and public interest and those kinds of things. So you are independent of what? Of this government? You have some sort of relationship with the DOC. You're contesting the department in court. It takes a position completely different from you. But you join the court action with COSATU. As what? Not as a friend of the court or a friend of COSATU. As a co-litigant. Since when does an independent regulator join court action with a civil society organization? What's so independent about you then? Against the very government that you're supposed to be serving. So I'd like to understand, what is your concept? As the councillors, as the CASA staff, CEO, what is your concept of this thing called independence? Because it's a thing that we are having grappling with, even with SADC. It's an independent public broadcaster. So what? What does it mean in real life? The second area of concern or question for me is, you know, the councillors, I mean, are full-time. Do they have a work plan? Does each councillor have a work plan for the year? Key performance indicators, like staff would have, senior managers. Are there projects that have been earmarked for particular councillors? Who monitors whether those projects are accomplished, concluded, or simply rolled over the next year and the following year and the following year? Who monitors attendance at work? Development comes to work today, do I report to somebody? As a member of parliament, if I don't come to work, I report to the chief work. Because the law allows us to remove councillors on specific grounds. But how do we measure your performance? Each of you earn probably R1 million as a basic package, I think. I don't know. Maybe I haven't got it right, but the total package is around in that area, in that region. What value do we get for R1 million from each of you? And how do I measure it? Because you're supposed to account to us and report to us. And we go through an elaborate process of interviewing and selecting you to serve in this committee, now in this council. In addition to a professional full-time staff. So I'd like to hear you on that, because I think we have to begin to set some performance standards, and some reporting to us on the performance of every councillor, not of the ICASA as an institution. I mean, you are recommended by us for employment, and we have to then measure your performance. I might be getting it wrong, but I really think that we need to start moving in that direction. So I'd like to hear you out, because I think I want to suggest perhaps a regular format for reporting rather than just annual reporting. Maybe a quarterly system of reporting on what are the specific targets for particular councillors. Have they achieved those targets? Have they complied? So then we can call in one person and say, look here, man, you know, you had these targets in the last 6 months. And can you just explain why you didn't succeed? Were there structural problems, or systemic problems, or financial problems, or capacity? But what was it that you were unable to meet your targets? The third area that I'm concerned about is this international trip that many councillors undertake. I think they take quite a few international trips. That's the sense I'm getting. How is it related to your work? I've seen there's quite a big amount in the expenditure here. I mean, the CEO has given me a breakdown of a more detailed expenditure system here. International trips seem to be quite a big part of your expenditure. Who authorizes these trips? How are they related to your core responsibilities for that particular year, in terms of your projects, etc.? Or is it just good to have this international trip because there's a conference somewhere, you think it's nice for you to go, and then you go. And there's no structured way in which you report that, you don't feed back into the organization, there's no value add to the organization. I'd like to hear your views on that, because I think we need to move in a different direction. President Heskey has been clear in all his pronouncements recently that the public service and state-owned entities are suffering. But there must be a measuring tool by which we can assess whether people are working or not working. Now, you have, as I said, we have a loaded structure. You have a full-time council, you have full-time staff. We don't decide on the staff. That, I suppose, is under the ambit of the CEO, and he has to look at performance issues, etc. But you fall under us. And we'd like to know how we're going to manage this relationship over the next 5 years.
The CEO will deal on issues relating to the budget. I'd like to make it clear to all and sundry, to world at large, that the issues relating to Vodacom or Vodafone Telecom issues were not properly handled by ICASA. We are filled with contrition, with remorse and regret in terms of how, at the latter stage of this, we dealt with this matter. And we fell off our horse, and it was a bad experience, but it's the one from which all of us have to learn. I think it is with regret that I can say, without any equivocation, we were wrong in having to reverse our decision. Under normal circumstances, this should not have happened. I would like to point out that we are all aware of our role and responsibility in the bigger scheme of things in South Africa. We are at the heart of a very, very strategic corner wherein we can make it or break it. And this, with regret, was most unfortunate that it ever happened. We know our role and responsibility. Ours, as I pointed out, is to implement government policy.
within the confines of the Act. As long as within the law, in terms of the ECA, and government policies put out in terms of the objectives, etc., or whatever issue they come up with, as long as it fulfills the role, the constraints pertaining to the Act, we will implement. And to a great extent, we have done that. This really is a kind of a deep, maybe history will come to judge us on this. I can submit that we are all filled with contrition. We are self-flagellating, as it were, with an understanding that we did it wrong and we should never repeat this thing again. The question of independence should be clearly understood. As I already pointed out, we implement government policy within the confines of the Act. Our independence relates with whether we handle an issue objectively, transparently. And finally, it is reasoned out that it will meet the test of legal review. Once we are convinced that what we have done is correct, we know that from time to time, one person's analysis given the same fact will be different from another person's conclusion on the basis of the same fact. I mean, go to university, etc. People don't come. Lawyers argue. They have the same fact, etc. We do it on the basis of what we have looked at in terms of the data, which provides information to us, and then decision making. This is the extent to which our independence is all about. Not that I will do this, I don't care what you say. We say, is this reasoned out? Are we doing it within the Act? And once we are convinced, we rather choose to go full steam and have our decisions reviewed by a court of law, official fuitus, which clearly indicates that any regulator's decision can only be assailed by a court of law. This is where we faltered. And that should not have happened, because we undermined Telecoms Regulation 101. That was the basic aspect that we, probably in our complacency, that was never taken into consideration, that you are faltering here. As you look at the bigger picture, do you understand what the implications of these things are? I can confess that I was approached by other people, and I told those people, kindly so, that there's nothing I can do about this. We rather meet in a court of law and give our reasons why we decided the manner in which we did. Now, in that particular regret, I respect, as I say, we regret, and I think we fell off our horse, and we are filled with contrition, we are self-flagellating, and we can say that we did it wrong, we're sorry about this. Given the same circumstances the next time around, we'll not do it the same way, because we'll be guided by reasoning, analysis, and the analysis will lead us to a conclusion as to how we arrive at the decision. So I just want to point out that our independence is clearly about doing things the right way, within the confines of the law, as long as it fulfills the objectives of the government. With regards to our wider plan...
Sorry. Is that the collective view of the council? Because I still want to ask a few more questions on that.
Okay. I speak with a full understanding that councillors concur with this view.
All right, can I just follow up then? You see, I think you must understand the seriousness of the statements you have made. Was the CEO present at that meeting when the decision was taken? Was the company secretary present at the meeting when the decision was taken? Were there minutes of those meetings? And were proper procedures followed in instructing legal firms to act on behalf of ICASA? I'd like the CEO to know whether he has authorized this expenditure. If he hasn't, I want to know who's going to be liable for this expense. That's the cost of your lawyers plus the other cost. Who is liable? Because I want to make it very clear. I'm going to put this on record. I'm going to be seeking guidance from National Treasury on this matter. I don't have the full, you know, understanding of the regulations, but I want to know who authorized the securing of lawyers and whether the CEO is taking responsibility, because I think he's the accounting officer. I'd like him to respond to this.
I think this particular respect, the ICASA Act allows any two councillors to approach the chairperson or the acting chairperson at any particular time to call for a meeting if it is seen urgent to discuss what would be considered as pertinent at that point in time. I believe, because I was not there, I was in Lesotho, that they met and they were correct when this decision was reversed. But I think they can provide more details about that.
On my behalf as CEO, I was in the building when the decision was made, but I was not at the meeting. I was not informed of the decision, either when it was taken. I was told only substantially after the meeting transpired that the council had decided on its own to seek legal advice on the matter. The issue of an instruction to the GMs is normally conducted through the office of the CEO. This did not take place. The instruction to seek legal advice went from counsel, as it meant, to the GM legal.
Were you invited and met the meeting, or you were not invited to that meeting as a CEO?
I was not invited. This was a meeting in caucus. In effect, it means it's only a meeting of the councillors which took this decision.
Are there minutes of the meeting? And can that be made available to us? And who drafted the minutes? What's the standard procedure? We don't know. Is it the company secretary, or what's the procedure? We'd like to understand that.
For caucus minutes, normally they are drafted by councillor in that meeting, but certainly they will be made available to the committee.
Okay, if these minutes can be available as soon as possible to us, so that you can be able to scrutinize and check what happened.
I just check, I mean, this, the question of costs, what is your understanding, Mr. Motana, about the implications of this? I mean, you're the accounting officer, are you going to carry this can? Are you authorizing this expenditure? We really need guidance on this. As I said, that we're going to have to take this matter up with National Treasury.
Council is entitled to instruct external legal attorneys. They have a right to do so, but ordinarily when they do so, they would have to issue an instruction to me to tell the GM legal, the general manager in charge of the function, to seek external attorney to obtain an opinion to defend ICASA, and the accounting for that will be done through my office as the accounting officer. In this instance, I was not told of any instruction that went to the general manager. And in this regard, one would assume that in the fullness of time, an invoice will come to ICASA in respect of the payment of these fees, and council will have to decide if they will have to have a post facto
resolution authorizing payment of this expenditure.
Supervani?
No, I hear, Chair, that the under normal circumstances is approved by the CEO. What is his view in this matter? Was there any breach of any procedure in relation to this matter?
In the ordinary course, all instructions to staff from council must come to the CEO. There is no basis for council to instruct staff other than through the office of the CEO.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, as we have heard about the fruitless expenditure, I will call it, that it has happened. Knowing the PSMA, it states clear. When you have used money that are not budgeted for, it's called fruitless expense. And the PSMA, it will point out the procedures that the manager or the COO, the steps that you should take to discipline the relevant council or country. Now, in this instance, if that happens, will the CEO do so? Or what is he going to do? Because it's the council who did that. I didn't check, Chairperson, the legislation that I haven't, you know, go through very well. The legislation that mandates the council. If that happens, what is the situation? I just want to need a clarity on that.
Okay, I just wanted to know if the GM legal is perhaps present in the meeting so that we can just also have on record how things happened, why it happened in this fashion, and also being the person in that very key position and a person who should actually have directed action which should be in line with the PFMI. If we could just ask the person to explain to us under what circumstances it happened that he proceeded to instruct and get legal firm involved. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think the context of the matter is that the matter had been before ICASA for quite some time. Legal advice furnished on several occasions, and on this specific day, I was called and informed of a decision that council had taken, and I then immediately contacted the CEO to alert him and to inquire whether he's aware of the decision and the implications, and I'm sure he can take it from there. That is the CEO.
Mr.
Colan,
we'll give you a chance.
Okay. Maybe, Chair, we are moving too fast on the matter. There is one aspect, Chair, which we didn't ask, in particular from my side. The council is aware about this matter.
since it has happened. The chairperson has articulated even where he thinks things has not went well in relation to this matter to take that particular decision. What is the cause of action which has been taken by the council? Until up to now, you come and account to the portfolio committee. What is it which the council has done till up to now, Chair? I'm just trying to raise that because maybe we are raising issues whereas already there's a process within the council itself. But I don't think that the way the chairperson has articulated the matter, they could just sit and relax and not do anything. Because if they do that, it will be clear that chair, they are disowning or they are not performing their duties as they're supposed to, as council. If there's nothing has happened until up to now. So in that context, I would like to know what has been the cause of exit in relation to this matter before they came here to us and we start to pose the question and raise it.
Chair, let me maybe try to assist as the one person who attended the meeting. I should indicate that the meeting indeed took place, and six of us were in that meeting, which took this decision. And what has happened ever since, as the chair clearly indicated, there has been a reflection on this matter, and all of us, up to my own understanding, agree that the decision that was taken in that meeting was very problematic in a number of ways, and one can go to town to articulate that. So those of us who sat in that meeting do admit that that is not what a good regulator is supposed to do, and we take responsibility and even an undertaking that it will never happen again. Now, in terms of expenditure, what the CEO has said, it is very correct, but that's how we work in procedure. To an extent that the extent of the matter is that something was done which was wrong. And the question will be whether this is a fruitless expenditure or an irregular expenditure. Because the money was not taken by people as individual persons. But what has happened is that the money was used to fund a particular decision that was taken wrong as this by the authority. So my own understanding, if you ask me where we are now in terms of this issue, we are at that situation where we have reflected on the matter. We have come to a conclusion that it was a wrong decision to take and that it should not happen again. There are other matters that we need to also address in terms of regulations. But I think the whole confusion around this matter has also been created by the nature of the current ownership and control regulation, you know, which is just very difficult to interpret at times. And one thing that's being done now is to review the ownership and control regulation and make sure that there is a clarity and no ambiguity in the implementation of this regulation. These regulations came before the ECA. And this was a period when the minister used to approve regulations, so that it came in the old dispensation. And there are some disjunctures when they are read with the current provisions of the ECA. So part of resolving this problem in its wider sense is to also address the regulatory chasm that has been recognized by the authority. And in terms of the minutes, as colleagues have indicated, we have worked on the minutes, and the minutes will be advanced to the committee without any delay.
Thank you, Secretary. I just want to know from the last response of the councillor. Now that some of the people who are present are responding, it becomes more clearer to me.
that the involvement of the councillors in this office, it cannot end like that and say you reflected on the matter. And I think here you are an independent communications authority of South Africa. And you are accountable someone. And where does it reflect on your budget report? Because it involves funds. And that is becoming more questionable now. Maybe you can elaborate more so as to explain.
Well, in terms of the invoices, obviously we all know that there will be invoices coming with regard to this particular matter. I personally don't know how much it will amount to. Perhaps when that information comes, we'll still have to compile a comprehensive submission to the committee to say that after our discussion, we have received the invoices and they amount to so much money, so that we, as you correctly say, account for that. And if it means that we need to make a further representation to the committee in light of whatever cost would have been accrued, I think that will have to be considered.
What went into the mind of the councillors to ignore the normal procedure of doing things via the CEO and chose to go direct to the GM? What was the reason? Can someone explain that particular issue? Why they decided to deviate from the normal process to go to the CEO, and that day, after that decision, they decided to go direct to the GM? Because you see, Chef, if you take it from there, they knew what they were doing. And they knew what is the implication of going direct to the CEO with that particular decision or resolution of Congress. Why you didn't use the normal route of doing things in this time around, you decide to go straight to the GM, to the CEO? Why? I think we need that explanation. Why did it happen in that manner, in that particular case?
Just to add a little bit, if we can probe a little further, Chair. From the response of the GM, and the response of the CEO, I don't know if it's just my understanding, but it seems that there is a little bit of a inconsistency. Can we just get absolute clarity on the position there? And secondly, can I just say that I still need to know if six councillors took the decision, which is six are necessary to call right, I believe, six took the decision, were they unanimous in the decision, and was there anybody who alerted them about the risk to the, you know, if we're looking at compliance, risk, and audit, was there anybody who alerted the body amongst themselves about the implications of such a decision?
Here we have a follow-up question. When the GM legal approached the CEO, what did the CEO say? Did he say yes, go ahead? Did he authorize this?
Chair, just consulted with what four of us are present here, those of us were in that meeting. And because the discussions that took place affect some operators, we were going to ask that we excuse other people in the house, and we then take the committee through what actually happened. Because some of the discussions that took place, we will give every information of what happened, what triggered the meeting, who was there, and everything to the committee. But we're just saying that for a fact that it affects some of the operators, maybe it's better we are left to remain with the committee and just go through the actual details of what actually happened. Just that is a plea from us. We're prepared to account to take the committee through what actually happened and what triggered that meeting. That we will do, but we're just saying that given the fact that it may affect some of the stakeholders, and it's better we create the committee.
May I? Chairperson, was the matter so urgent that you can't even wait for the chairperson of the council to come and deal with the matter? Thanks.
Chairperson, I was the acting chairperson on that day, and I would like to support what Councillor Nkuna has just said, because I think it will assist us if we are frank and open about this, but it will also be unadvisable to do this in the presence of operators. So if perhaps we could excuse our people in the house, then we can deal with this matter.
There's a request for a portion of this meeting to be closed.
It is going to help us to understand what really happened. We are prepared to go that route, but we need to know what really happened.
Jesse?
Can I suggest that let us finish other matters, then afterwards, then the councillors would remain behind and with the committee, then we can decide any matter, as long as that matter will not also raise the other question of why we let the other stakeholders out if they will need them at a later stage. But I would suggest that let us solve it, let us start it, then let us deal with it as a last matter.
I think that would be a more sensible way to go. Can you respond to the other sets of questions? We will hold the all issues on the Vodacom thing now.
Yeah.
Can you respond to the performance of councillors and all the other related matters?
Right. The strategic plan for this year would clearly indicate that councillors are individually allocated projects which are encapsulated in the strategic plan, for which they will be accountable on a quarterly basis in terms of progress. Includes all the councillors, some have got three, some two. I also have some, even though I will be managing the program when the meeting is held to look at what the progress is with regard to performance on a quarterly basis, the expenditure, the timing, as well as the quality output at that point in time. So that already is covered in this particular respect. And you will be provided with information that pertains to each and every councillor as to which projects there are. We do have them. I don't know if they're in the package, but separately we do have all of those projects for which each councillor will have to account individually for progress made in that regard.
Account to who?
Account, well, we will submit. If you ask for a quarterly report, we'll give you the quarterly report. Normally what we would do, we would discuss progress on a quarterly basis. And then at the end of the year, we will indicate the projects that would have been achieved. But since you require that, at least you have to know on an ongoing basis, and we will have quarterly reports on this, we'll pass them on to the committee on a quarterly basis.
That you will submit quarterly reports to us on the performance of councillors.
I think that's the requirement of
thank you.
Committee. And I think we're obliged, since we are accountable, whichever manner and way in which you would like us to account, we are at your mercy. Can I finish? Councillor Nkuna will come in. I just want to point out with regard to international trips. There is an obligation for us to look at matters relating to what will affect us as a country, which are of an international nature, like the ITU, where a lot of developments are taking place with regard to bombplex. We're in the Region 1, so whatever happens in Region 1, we are bound, and we can influence policies, regulations in that particular regard. So those are a must, if I were to use that term. But there are other
trips for which some of us have been invited, me in particular, to address them on matters of convergence, of regulations, of competition, and any other matter. So those I do attend to make them aware, because sometimes we also need to be heard, so that when foreign investors come in, they should know what the regulator is all about. That's why it's so serious and important that the regulator should really, really be up to, because it plays a very, very important role in advancement and socioeconomic development of this country. There are inquiries from all over the world about prospective investors here, and I want to know the certainty about them putting money in here. So I have got to go and reassure them that this is a safe place to provide services and get a fair return, because we know that the advancement of the society is through allowing foreign direct investment, which in itself leaves quite a lot in terms of skills and also job creation and also the advancement of society. We can't just be a desert on our own and hope that we'll be at the same level as other countries. So those are some of the obligations
Can we get a schedule of all trips undertaken by councils in the last financial year?
Yes, we certainly will.
And time period? And also, what are the proposed trips for this year?
That's very true.
So that we can assess whether, you know, people are more out of the country than in the country.
That will be provided. Do you want to put in, or can I continue some of the questions?
Sorry, Chair. I wanted also to understand who approves the trip. Who authorized? Who gave authorization?
Okay. Actually, the authorization is done via a council round-robin resolution. All councillors must sign to allow that particular councillor to travel.
So on that, Chairperson, I just want to find out, now that we are saying this, that the ICASA, as a council, you have the obligation to attend the international conferences on the matter. Now, on the other day here, we have, I think is it DOC, came to do a presentation, and they've mentioned that there was a presidential commission, if I'm correct. Now, my question, what is the relationship of, not as an individual, but I'll use the word council, the relationship of that presidential commission on ICT? What is the relationship? Perhaps you sit on that, but I don't know. Maybe one of the council members sits there, I don't know.
What I call Presidential International Advisory Committee. I am part, as an individual representing CASA, I'm part and parcel of that commission, and I advise them on matters relating to regulation and what the prospects, because most of them are actually ICT companies that are advising in that, and I make them aware of the possibilities that are there with regards to investing in South Africa. I'm part of that representing ICASA in that Presidential International Advisory Commission.
Just maybe a quick addition on the international issues. We have certain institutions that we are part of. And these institutions include, in the postal sector, we have an organization called SAPRA, the Southern Africa Postal Regulators Association. It's an association of regulators involved in postal matters. And this has been established in terms of the subject protocol on transport, telecommunications, and meteorology. So all regulators in the region participate in that organization. At the continental level, still on postal, we participate in an organization called PAPU, the Pan-African Postal Union. Traditionally, it was established as part of the Organization of African Unity. So all the countries are members of this institution. Now it works within the auspices of the AU. At an international level, we participate in the Universal Postal Union, which is a UN specialized agency for postal services. And that kind of trend repeats itself when it comes to telecoms and broadcasting, where we are a founder member of an organization called CASA, the Communications Regulators Association of Southern Africa, which also has been established in terms of the SADC protocol. There are continental institutions that have also been established within the auspices of the EU, and internationally, we participate in the international telecoms union. It has been said when you compare with other regulators, let's say, for example, the Tanzanian regulator, they participate in about 6 study groups of the ITU, because that's where issues are discussed before they go to the World Radio Conference or Assembly. So we have not been sufficiently participating in those study groups, and I think we need to beef up our participation there. And what we do as a collective, we sit down and allocate each other to say that you will focus on this area. For example, I focus on Southern Africa dealing with the telecommunications issues. There are people who deal with postal issues. So each and every councillor has been allocated an area of focus. And as it comes to decision making, there is a budget for international travel that is known beforehand, to an extent that by the time we approve a trip for a particular councillor, already it is within what has been budgeted in the context of what we have said. There are, of course, instances that we go into undertake studies, and now a decision has been taken to reduce the number of international studies that you do outside in favor of doing studies internally. So if you look at the current budget of the current travel budget, it has reduced considerably, especially that the budget that relates to the work that councillors do.
Questions? There was a question of between David and Goliath with regard to operators and ICASA. Without a doubt, the operators are Goliath. But ICASA is not as yet a David. We don't have the sling as yet. Clearly, we are outweighed in this. We try to, it's like a heavyweight boxer with a flyweight boxer getting into the ring. The result is very, very obvious. And largely it's a matter of resources and nothing else. Operators are well resourced financially. And they can be able, and they have to a very great extent, through our vigorous training program of making sure that we are on top of things with regard to regulation, poach from us. Now that's a big vessel. We don't have indentured labor here where we can hold someone and say, no, you're not going anywhere. You know, the choice is not like this. It's a free market. Capital and human resources can go anywhere they choose. They can go overseas, and some would speak with you because of certain advantages that they have. Maybe they like ICASA. The environment is conducive to them, maybe they learn a lot, etc. But over a period of time, especially in these trying times, you know, financially, you know, especially when you talk about people who are middle-class, they're already bonded to the banks. They have a house, they have a car. And it's not like people working class, they really don't have such problems. And so we end up becoming slaves of capital. There's no doubt about that. And we want to obey and make sure that we listen to our bosses so that we can pay off our debt. So in that particular, the operators are successful in identifying that weakness. That, sure, he will want to have a Mercedes-Benz and he's driving a hatchback. Let him come over, and they do come. So in that regard, we are really... we have one of our guys who was a staff, Calvert. He's now heading Multi-Choice and Obicom, etc. and all that. He was groomed from ICASA. Just an example. Thanks for making my way back, Shikana.
You're right. I've seen that other car that Mercedes outside. Latest model. At least, I suppose.
With regards to monitoring
of compliance. I think the question was asked with regards to ensuring that we protect consumer interest. Certainly, in most cases, we are not able to be everywhere. We largely depend on people raising complaints that have not been fairly dealt with. And in that manner, not that we don't do monitoring ourselves, we certainly do monitoring, but I'm just pointing out that the task of reporting non-compliance lies with a consumer who has been failed in terms of the delivery of the services. And we have a complaints and compliance committee. First, we ask the operator to provide redress, failing which we hold that operator before the Complaints and Compliance Committee at ICASA, and a due process is undertaken. If found to be a fault, sanctions will be imposed. Could be a fine, could be a warning. You know, there's a whole range of sanctions that could be imposed. The E-rate, essentially, just to bring the matter nearer home, was designed to address public schools. But there's a section there that also talks to independent schools, you know, the Model Cs, etc. In that particular, it is the minister who can make a decision whether the independent schools are also subject to E-rate. Because under normal circumstances, they can afford. But there is that discretion that lies with the minister, whether independent schools are also subject to the E-rate. So that also we have brought forth before DOC to make a determination. We had the regulations in place, but then we wanted to sort that one out as well as, you know, zero-rated schools. The other question of SABC versus ICASA, I just picked up. Okay, the role of covering elections. That in itself came from our regulations in terms of how we read the act relating to election coverage. We worked it out on the basis, as I say, regulations are actually an elaboration of the act. It's just that if the regulations were put, the act would be this big. So the regulations give you the framework, I mean the act gives you the framework around which you must formulate the regulations that are consistent with the act. That anybody who reads it said, no, you did not violate what your mandate was. So in that particular regard, the allocation of seats were equitably allocated, the seats were equitably allocated, not equally, by the regulator. Equitably, I think that's the operative word, because we depended on the number of seats you had currently for you to be allocated equitable time. So that's really what, I think we made also a concession on others who had not been there by just giving them, you know, just say a period of certain minutes all across the board, notwithstanding the fact that they had no representation. Example, COPE. Well, that's equity, you know. That's what we would really consider. We must try to be as fair as we can for all voices to be heard, because this was a democratic election. So if that was the only channel that was available, let them be heard. And that's really the discretion that we used. There we applied our discretion. And I think nobody has taken us to court for that. And we thank your consideration. But very true, interconnection is the vein of contention, if I were to put it that, in terms of cost of communication. The difficulty that arises with us coming and imposing interconnection without going through Chapter 10 is a matter that, if we don't observe processes and procedures, will be taken slam-bang right into the courtroom. And that process is so laborious, it's almost more like an ear passage, it's a labyrinth that we are thinking that we should send recommendation for amendment of the act in that regard, so as to shorten it. Because under the circumstances, it will take years before we can even come up to the point where we would say, we think this is what you should price. You have to determine that those people are significant market players. Even if it is apparent, that's the most interesting part. They produce their annual report and they tell you what market share they have. For instance, Vodacom could be having 54%. On that basis, they hit the threshold of S&P. Then we should move in and say, let's see whether you are abusing your dominance. We cannot move into that area until we go through the process itself. Hearings, etc., collecting information and all that. But we will certainly be reviewing the ECA in its entirety, because our objective is to advise the minister where we are not able to implement policy objectives because the manner in which the act was drafted went contrary to the intended objectives. And I think we're working on that. Within a month or so, we should be coming with proposals for amendment of the Electronic Communications Act. But it's true that the matter had already been undertaken in the previous dispensation. But we're made aware that why continue with this when a new act is coming into being, which is different from the framework of the Telecoms Act. That, of course, resulted in our delay. Now we are new in a new dispensation and we are reading the Chapter 10 holistically to find out which markets are there and work through Chapter 10 to see where there is dominance, etc., with submissions of information from the operators to be very honest about the data, because it is out of the data that correct information can be determined and the right decision made. If we operate on wrong data, again, which is a thumbsuck, would be a little bit dangerous. So, clearly, we have sorted out that one out of why we differed with the DC, and we say we are filled with contrition. We really feel sorry about this, and given the same circumstances, once more again, we fell off our horse, and we were not blinkers in this respect, but we just fell off our horse, and I think we'll ride back again and come back on spring. So quite a lot of questions on that. Yeah, the working relationship with the Centec with regards to reliability, where a radio suddenly is not able to be on air for a period of time. The obligation is to that broadcaster, not to Centec, because we have licensed the broadcaster. So in that respect, our relationship is with the broadcaster. And then, of course, that is brought forth because they have to compile a report in terms of their license obligation as to what could have happened. Maybe there could be force majeure, something that they do not have control over. But if it's because of some difficulties that are easily resolvable, like maybe a radio announcer sleeping on his job, you know, forgetting that he's on air, not saying anything, you know, that's the thing that can be explained as to why were you off air for a period of time.
No, on that one, Chair, is that most of this report, they rely on Centec to provide them the reason why there was that a blackout or something like that. Yeah. So that's why I'm asking. Yeah, in terms of the relationship, because sometimes they wait for the Centec to give them the reason, because they have to report to you, and yeah, that's right.
There's all normally, a relationship between the broadcasters and a relationship between the broadcasters and Centec. But the obligation is towards the broadcasters. Whatever difficulties they have there, they can come to us and tell us what difficult, but there's always a service level agreement between any two people who are conducting a business. And there are penalties if there is a contract. If you don't provide, there should be stipulation as to what should happen. So in that particular respect,
it will be them who would say, well, you know, it will be a domino effect. We will deal with them and they will deal with Semtech in terms of, if that is the case, in terms of failing to program. It could be a lightning strike of some sort. And one other thing I want to say, but airwaves are not 100% reliable. Depending on the weather and any other kinds of thing, the signal can fall off. So one should also look at force majeure in that regard. You want to take this one off? Maybe. Let me take a breather a little bit.
Okay.
There's one here. I think this is properly written than I could have. You know, I scribble like a doctor sometimes. With regard to monitoring compliance vis-à-vis municipality delivering their own mail, you know, that's another difficult issue. If that is happening there and SAPO is conscious, they should report that matter to us. And then we can do a mystery shopping of some sort. And then come up with, you know, So, in that particular respect, I would say that if there was a complaint brought to us, we certainly should have dealt with it. I'm not too sure.
Yes. Actually, in 2008, SAPO complained in respect to certain municipalities in respect to delivery of mail, and we subsequently sent letters, our compliance division sent letters in respect to those municipalities, and they were told to stop doing such activities. Some of them actually responded and said that they were not aware of such activities taking place. And some indicated that they do deliver mail in areas where SAPO has failed to deploy addresses, because the municipalities have a duty of actually ensuring that you get your bill at the end of the month. So currently, a compliance report is being done by the unit, and possible contraventions will be referred to the CCC, that is the compliance committee, complaints and compliance committee through council, and just to ensure that we actually continue to deal with SAPO. We're in constant engagement with SAPO on these issues. The office of the CEO and some of the GMs meet with SAPO in respect to compliance matters before they are brought to council.
Let me tell you, SAPO was here a few days ago. And they raised a very serious concern about it. And their complaint is that the ICASA is doing very little about this matter. So it's pointless saying that you are meeting them and you are written to the council. A year has passed from what we can understand since the original complaint was lodged. And what it boils down to is that no firm and decisive action has been taken by ICASA. And that's the issue. Because, I mean, you see, the point is that these people are breaching conditions or defying certain instructions. Do you take 6 years to respond? What's your enforcement capacity? Otherwise, then you must abolish the fee that the post office must pay. But you can't insist on the fees. I mean, I'm using the layperson's language of fees. I don't understand what's the right term for it, whatever it is. And then you don't enforce on your side.
It must have fallen through the cracks if that is the case. But it's unfortunate again, let me point out. But there are people who are from the operational side to deal with matters of this nature. They can only come to council if matters come to a crux. But ordinarily, if this is reported with the monitoring, complaints, and compliance division, that has to really see to it that these things are followed through. And much as council, we don't want to interfere in operational matters, because if this is reported to me, again, if I say, Mr. Compliance Committee, what are you doing about it? It could be seen as interfering. Whereas now it comes up here and we are taking the flag. So again, you know, it must be sort of a very, very difficult terrain that one finds oneself. Because at the end of the day, we are accountable. Even though the responsibility could be somewhere else. And in that particular regard, I think I'll refer this matter to the CEO to deal with, without going to the individual head who's supposed to be handling these matters, to speedily deal with this matter because it has come to the fore.
Are we finished with the responses?
And self-subsidy. We actually are working on it right now. By the fourth quarter, we'll already have published the regulations. What happens normally is we have learned from previous experiences that we need to vet our regulations to see that they can withstand legal scrutiny, so that we don't get embarrassed again and find ourselves that we missed out the step. Most of the difficulties that we're probably experiencing are the processes. If we miss the process, clearly the operators are sharp at that. Say, we can see the substance, but you missed the step in the process. So we normally consult with our internal legal general manager to look at any regulation that we come up with for vetting, and if he finds that there is a difficulty that he cannot fathom the way in which the committee have structured their regulations, then he points out there's a difficulty here. If it cannot be ironed between the, the committee and the general manager, then he says, okay, let all viewpoints be put forth to an objective person. And that's when we take the last step of getting someone outside the legal, external legal opinion on this matter. And then, of course, we bring that forth, we look at it at council, and then we make, hopefully, an informed, educated decision, an intelligent one for that matter.
Can I just get time? Now, thank you for all the responses, because we want to have a closed session. But can I just get the response, this thing of the reporting for work, for duty, on the part of council? Is there a system in place by which it is monitored? And everybody who goes to work, there must be a system by which you measure. So if tomorrow council of Andalusia says, hey man, that cloud looks very bad, they are not going to work. Is it acceptable? How do we, who monitors attendance in your system?
Everybody has got an access card, which has to be swiped to show that that person reported what you see. And also, when that person has to leave, it can be known what kind that person is. And the records could be collected to find out whether any other person has been at work on such a duty or whether that person reported, etc. Normally, when someone is absent, that person has got, if that person has got to go and leave, that person has got to file a leave form before going on leave. But there could be circumstances of emergency situation where someone says, you know what, I have a problem, my train is leaking, etc. I won't be coming to work today. Then that's understandable. But under normal circumstances, you have to, even if you are sick, you still have got to file in sick leave form. But if you are sick for 3 days or more, you got to bring a doctor's certificate. That's the procedure that needs to happen. I don't normally go around. The counselors file it with me, and the general managers, and it goes according to rank. Whoever reports to the other person should find. But with the council, all leave forms and sick leave forms are to be signed. But
can we?
Just one.
Sorry, just to respond to one question that was asked about the budget for engineering. The finance, the money for that comes from our CAPEX budget, which is not stated here because this is an operating budget. And the CAPEX really arises from retained interest on revenue.
essence, when the operators here, licensees, we're paying over plus minus 2 billion to Treasury. Treasury allows us to keep the interest on that money when it is kept in a bank account prior to transfer that money to the National Treasury. We use that money to fund CAPEX, and that's what we use to buy engineering equipment, IT equipment. And that's reflected in our financial statements.
Chakurwani?
It's a small matter. I hear the chairperson is saying that the system is right and so on. Who checked the record? I'm saying, who checked the record? I hear the system can be there, you can write and record and so on, but then who check those records, audit the activities of those records. I will tell you why it's our first year. By tomorrow, the office of the chief will know how many ANC members attended the portfolio committee because it will be consolidated and sent to the board. So he'll be knowing by tomorrow how many members were here in this meeting, or even if we're in the house, we sign it in sense. So in your case, is there any monitoring, or is when there's a problem, then one can go back and check?
I think there isn't an active monitoring. Because of a situation that warrants, then those could be extracted.
You see, what my concern is here, it's a systemic problem. You have a council of 10, or 9, 8, 9, and you have a chairperson. Now, yes, you are all councillors, but you have a chairperson. Is there any authority vested in the office of the chairperson that is different from that of the ordinary councillor? Is there a line of reporting? Because I know that last year when you came, the sense I got is that now you are all equals, I don't report to the chairperson. Early on also when you raised this thing about the post office, you said, but look, if it's the chairperson, if I confront the councillor concerned, then you know, it's a bit of an issue. Why are you asking me all these questions? I mean, you're just a councillor like me. Well, then why don't we just have 9 councillors and then every month, whenever they meet, they can appoint their own chairperson? Why do we have the position of a chairperson if there isn't a line of authority? And I guess that your salary package will be slightly different from that of an ordinary councillor. Now, I think we want to get this clear. Maybe if we don't have a system in place, but we want clarity on this so we know who to hold accountable for certain things. I think the signal we want to give is that yesterday was yesterday, today there's something new. From this committee, it could be different. And we want to see proper systems in place so that people can report accordingly.
Thanks. I asked a question, your relationship between the electric monitoring system with ESCOM. I didn't think it made an answer.
Question?
No, it's
not to what she said, because I thought in terms of a system that would really audit at the end, it would be somewhere where the chairperson could show us on the organogram how it goes on as far as the organogram is there, because they have a general management human resource somewhere here. I thought it won't be difficult for the chairperson to tell us exactly where it lies.
Between us and ESCOM. ESCOM has got a private electronic communications network which is for self-use. In other words, to do their internal operation, which is not for commercial purposes. And that is different from any other entity like Telcom or Vodacom, etc. And in that particular, it's sort of an exempt license in a way. Unless they've got enough capacity to sell, but then they would be subject to certain strictures or regulation as to what extra capacity they would sell. For instance, if they have got fiber, fiber capacity is very immense, and they may have extra which they can
enterprise, you then will provide conditions, the same conditions, under what conditions you should sell, and all of that.
Chair, I wanted to respond to your question around the duties of the chairperson. The CASA Act is quite clear that the chairperson manages the activities of council. And I suppose the gap is in terms of saying exactly how that management should be attended, and that's where your executive system should come into play. Because I suppose it's not only a question of reporting for duty, but it's also a question of, if I'm on a particular project, before I come to this committee, really the chairperson should have a clearer understanding of what my project entails and whether I'm doing my job or not. So I think that's the gap that you currently have, and it's really dependent on the goodwill of councillors to say, if I'm not coming to work, I file a leave form with the chairperson. If I don't, well, it's okay. And in terms of performance on projects, also it depends really on the goodwill of councillors.
Yeah, just quickly, on the issue of performance of CASA, if you look at 6A, Section 6A of the CASA Act, it does set out the procedure that should be followed, and that it says that the portfolio committee or the National Assembly, together with the Minister of Communications, should be responsible for the performance management of CASA. And what has happened, we wrote so many letters to the minister then, asking for this process to be triggered. Nothing, of course, happened to an extent that we have started work on our own internally, you know, to compile whatever we are doing as individual councillors. And that was also indicated to the minister when we met with the minister. So that part is likely to be taken care of because they've already been discussed with the minister. In terms of councillor's relationship with the chairperson, my understanding has always been that no councillor can be outside work without the chairperson's knowledge. So if you are going on leave, you have to fill a leave form and deposit it with the chairperson. And if you are not at work, maybe something happened before you leave this work. It is expected of councillors to inform the chairperson that I have this commitment whatsoever. And we also said that in terms of international travel, it has to be sanctioned by the collective of councillors. So a quorum of councillors has to agree that a particular councillor is going to attend a particular a meeting outside the country, for example.
Thank you very much. Going to the closed session now. I'm going to ask all operators, media, Paul, take a tape recorder with you, please. This is